And it was only with the end of the relationship, this epiphany I had about aging when I was misdiagnosed, and the subsequent journey that I went on by throwing myself into a meditation practice that made me look at my internal programs, that I realized actually he didn't matter. How he saw me didn't matter. How anyone else sees me doesn't matter. It's that I'd lost sight of myself and I really needed to learn who I am and stand in my own power. And I think that's how we can be visible again.
Welcome to Rights for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest.
Hello, my name is Meredith Jaffe, and I'm thrilled to be back on the convo couch for 2024 for Rights for Women. Today I'm chatting with the writer Jane Tara. Jane Tara has published over 100 children's books, several plays, YA and romance novels, as well as travel and educational books and journalism. She spent 13 years wandering the world and lived in 5 countries, but is now happily at home in Sydney. Jane is also the general manager of Better Reading, a community of engaged readers and a powerhouse of support for Australian writing. Today, we're here to talk about her new novel, Tilda Is Visible, one of the buzziest titles of the 2023 Frankfurt Book Fair. Kathy Lett has called it pitch perfect. Joanna Nell says it is delightfully original. Rachel Johns calls it fresh, funny, smart and warm. And Belinda Alexander says she laughed herself silly, and I'm adding my voice to those accolades. I'm looking forward to going behind the scenes with Jane today as we discuss the writing of Tilda Is Visible. Jane Tara, welcome.
Oh, thank you, Meredith. Thanks for having me on here. I love this podcast. I listen to you and Pam. And I'm thrilled to dig in deep.
Okay. I think we need to start with the obvious question and give our listeners an idea about who Tilda is at the start of the story. Can you give us an overview of who she is and where she is at in her life?
Yeah, so Tilda is in her early 50s. Life is pretty good. She's content. She is in a place where she is financially okay. She has good friends. She has adult daughters and who she has a great relationship with. Everything's all right. And one morning she wakes up and her little finger is missing. And she is diagnosed with invisibility. And that is a condition that's prevalent in women over 50. And she starts a journey where she needs to actually face her past before she completely disappears. And that includes a divorce, but mostly it includes childhood trauma. So I guess you asked who she is at the beginning, but by the end, this is a woman who, like so many of us, we're so used to doing everything for everyone else that we don't take that time out for ourselves sometimes to really look at who we are and see ourselves clearly, heal things in our past. And by the end of the novel, Tilda has done that. So that's the journey that she goes on.
Mm-hmm. On your website, you say Tilda Is Visible is the novel I always wanted to write, but first I had to live it. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah. In many ways, Tilda is me. She didn't start off that way. She was a very minor character in a little short story I wrote, and she stuck with me. I liked the idea of a woman disappearing, but she was very different then. But then she stuck with me for about 10 years. And so I started to explore the idea of Tilda, and then I started to write a bit more. And then, like many writers, this lockdown happened. And I had quite a manuscript by that point. I just had to finish it, but it still wasn't me. And I guess it was during that second lockdown that I really went in deep with Tilda, and it's like a spiral. The more I dug into her, the more I wanted her story to be authentic, I realized I needed to face my own and tell my own story. And so the two of us ended up merging in this fictional version. And it is fiction, really, it is fiction, but there are elements of my life that I've put into that. And I think that's why it's resonating with women, because I think they can sense that when they're reading it. The idea of a woman disappearing is unusual, but actually the story, my personal story, Tilda's personal story, is quite a common story, and so many of us have lived it in our own way.
I think it's the visibility issue is something that so many women can relate to. And I think that's where we need to start, because obviously that is the titular part of the story. So many women at a certain age start to notice that they're becoming invisible. As you say, Tilda wakes up one morning and then she can't see her little finger anymore. And then this spreads as the novel goes on, and we meet other characters, which we'll touch on a bit later. But I wanted to actually know, from a writer's point of view, did the idea of Tilda physically disappearing, was that part of the writing process, or was it originally just a sense of disappearance, if you know what I mean? Like, did you always think, oh, she will physically disappear?
Yes. Yeah. So that was the idea that dropped in. And I know that a lot of writers work like this. Like, quite often an idea will drop in. It's a real sense of the story, of the character. It's full and whole within itself, but then you need to find the rest of the book around it. So the idea of this, and when I had her in the short story, she actually was missing a little finger, but she was a very different character. She was English. She was a florist in my current one. She's a photographer. But it was that sense of the little finger is missing. What happens from here as a woman? I'm starting to disappear. It's that moment of recognition. What do I do about it?
I love that she goes along to the invisibility support group for women suffering from invisibility called the Invisibility Advocacy Organization, run by Brenda. Its focus is on supporting sufferers. These are hilarious scenes for the listeners out there, hilarious scenes, especially when you have such wonderful characters such as Carol, who is now totally invisible and has decided to go naked this summer because no one can see her but herself, so why bother? But it also felt like you were having a gentle prod at these kind of organizations. Is that right?
When I went into the edit, I realized that perhaps that had come out. I think that there is definitely room for these organizations. I guess what I wanted to show in Tilda was that, and this is a theme in the book, that we definitely get what we focus on. And so the book, this particular support group isn't very supportive. They're focused on their suffering and they get more of that. But I feel like by the end of the book, I really liked Brenda, who runs the support group. In my first draft, she was quite a small character, but she's got a mighty energy, and she came out in subsequent drafts and ended up being quite a powerhouse character who herself goes on a journey. And the way that she ends up perceiving the condition and herself at the end of the book has an influence on the support group. And because of that, it actually offers more support to women. I guess it's the idea of support. How can we support ourselves? And certainly the way that we view ourselves and the way we speak about things is so important. And so I like to think that the support group went on a journey as well by the end of the book.
It absolutely did, because when we start the novel, it is, Brenda practically says, this is about suffering. And Tilda's not the only one in the group. Carol and Erica in particular are like, yeah, that's not really helpful. And I really liked the fact, as you say, that Brenda ends up in a different place as well in the novel, which really rounds her out as a character. And then the other thing that's really wonderful is that Tilda, who, as you say, is divorced and has not really had much success in the dating game for women of a certain age. And she accidentally meets a guy called Patrick. And Patrick has a degenerative condition that means he will eventually be totally blind. And it's a lovely opposition to Tilda from a writing perspective, obviously, that she feels unseen and yet is seen by Patrick. But it's also, I'm assuming, based on your own health scare that you had a few years ago. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience and how it informed the writing of that character?
So the health scare that you're talking about was that I was misdiagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, and that is what Patrick in the book has. It was a series of tests. I received the diagnosis and then I was referred to the Centre for Eye Health at the University of New South Wales. But the appointment there, and they were apparently going to tell me where my sight was at, how much sight I had left, and give me a loose time frame of when I was going to lose my sight. That's what they told me. But that appointment was nearly 3 months away, like up from diagnosis to that appointment. I had close to 3 months where I thought I was potentially going to lose my sight. And of course, I did what Tilda does in the book. I drank wine in bed in my robe and did a deep dive into Google and tried to find out what my future had in store and all about sight and vision. And then I started to go down this other rabbit hole about what it even means to see. And I discovered these incredible like ophthalmologists out there who are using light and meditation and things like that. And some studies, one really interesting study was using people who were blind from birth and had taught them to see through their chest, to see images and things through their chest. Really fascinating. Where is the mind's eye? How do we see? These questions started to really, I started to reflect on them. And that's where the idea for this novel started. It was inspired by this period of time. But one thing happened to me during this time. I was looking in the mirror one day. I was 45 when this happened. And so I was already starting to feel invisible, certainly at home, and starting to feel invisible out of the home as well. There was a shift happening. And I was pretty critical of my wrinkles and myself. And one day I looked in the mirror and I just saw my face and I really, genuinely, profoundly loved what I saw and thought, oh my God, am I not going to see myself age? And it was a total shift. And I can honestly say that was 10 years ago. I can honestly say that I am rarely critical of what I see in the mirror now. It happens. There are times, but generally it is such a gift to see each line come up and the changes that happen as you get older. It's aging is a gift. To see yourself age is a gift. So many people don't make it and I'm just embracing it. So the merging of what it means to see and embracing getting older, that sort of occurred for this story to happen. And that was what I explored, really.
And the thing I really liked about Patrick too, he was a very able person. He was a highly successful business person. He was obviously didn't really know what he looked like, but was very attuned to the other sensory stimuli around him and saw Tilda in a way that even Tilda did not see herself. And I just thought that was a really magical part of her journey as well, as to be seen by someone who could not see, which was just a delightful sort of twist on that kind of idea.
I spoke to a few sight impaired people, and Patrick, a lot of his, I guess, approach to his condition was taken from a young woman who I spoke to and I thank in the acknowledgements. Absolutely phenomenal young woman who, you know, not only reads Braille in four languages or something, but also reads the Braille for music and just a really incredible approach to life. And so she really inspired a lot of his approach. And also she gave me sort of details about there's a condition that she used to have that is quite common apparently in sight impaired people where they can have these hallucinations. It's a Charles Bonnet, I think it's called, disorder. But anyway, she started meditating and was able to overcome that. So that sort of removed that problem from her condition. And so that's what I did for Patrick as well. But yeah, so it was a really interesting journey learning from these people as well about how they actually see the world.
Unlike Brenda from our invisibility advocacy group, the novel asks questions as to why women become invisible as we age. And you draw a line directly between intergenerational trauma or childhood trauma and disappearing. What is your argument? What is the connection?
I think there are so many reasons why women feel invisible, and I chose that one to explore. I could have, and I touch on patriarchy and society and the media and all of those things that just weaved in slightly, but I wanted this to be the reason for Tilda, I think, because it was mine. And this is, I needed to be really honest and authentic on the page. And I felt, I think so many women get into their 40s and we hit perimenopause. And we're only just starting to have a real conversation about perimenopause and menopause now. 10 years ago, when I was in perimenopause, this conversation wasn't occurring. I was in a pretty toxic relationship that had shades of the relationship in the novel. It's not completely that one, but shades of Tom, her ex-husband. And this perimenopause kind of shit show that was happening in my life every month, what comes first? Is it the stress of the relationship and not being seen and not being seen in your home, and you're doing everything for everyone and your hormones are going mental and you're being told that you're crazy, you know? And now women can go, oh, I'm not crazy. I'm actually in my 40s. It's perimenopause. I can get some help. But 10 years ago, I was like, oh, am I? And I honestly lost sight of myself, completely lost sight of myself in my 40s. And it was only with the end of the relationship, this epiphany I had about aging when I was misdiagnosed, and the subsequent journey that I went on by throwing myself into a meditation practice that made me look at my internal programs, that I realized actually he didn't matter. How he saw me didn't matter. How anyone else sees me doesn't matter. It's that I'd lost sight of myself and I really needed to learn who I am and stand in my own power. And I think that's how we can be visible again. And we're always going to be overlooked by the young hipster who's serving at the bar, or we're going to have the media against us, and there's a bigger conversation about the patriarchy and everything. But on a very personal level, I feel more visible now than I've ever felt in my life.
Interesting. And as you say, healing is a really important part of the story. I love that Tilda, with her friend, runs a company called This Is a Sign that puts inspirational quotes on merchandise, a lot of which Tilda confesses that she has no idea what they actually mean. She also sees Selma, a top-notch therapist, an older woman who is anything but invisible, and this is her part of her journey towards healing. And as you say, meditation, so she goes on a meditation retreat. So healing is also really important to you as a person. So I just wondered, in terms of that journey for you, how much of that personal journey did you think was important to inform the writing? What did you want to say about the importance of self-healing?
That it's possible. I mean, if people knew where I came from and my past and where I am today, it's possible. To heal is possible. But I think writing Tilda was, I talk about the spiral a lot, but it was rounds around the spiral. I didn't mean to write a sort of self-help fiction book to start with. I was just writing a story. I actually went into lockdown, the second lockdown, when I was committed to writing this. I really wanted to get this done. But just before we went into the second lockdown, I lost someone who I loved very dearly. Suddenly, he died of a heart attack. So I went into the second lockdown deep in grief, and just being stuck there in the house, not able to go anywhere, who knows what's happening in the world, grieving this man. And I just wrote and I meditated and I meditated because I know that it's a tool that can get you through anything in life. It really is. And so as that was happening, I weaved it into the story more. And also, I guess at the end of the day, this is something I enjoy. I love personal development. I'm a passionate meditator, but I'm not an expert in that field. I'm not going to write a book about meditation or self-help or neuroplasticity. All I can do is show rather than tell. So I can show how it has actually impacted my life through an entertaining story. And I thought if that was published out there because of my interest in personal development, I'd love to read it. But there's not a lot of that out there. So I thought, I'll write it.
The other thing I really love too, and this really spoke to me too, is I'm going to call her a character, although that's not quite correct, is Pearl.
Yes.
I can't even remember what it stands for now, but part of her therapy program with Selma is that she learns about Pearl. And you use that to great effect in the novel. Let's talk a little bit about what Pearl is and why you chose to have those internal conversations with Tilda and Pearl in the novel.
So Pearl is program everything, always repeat loop. And it's our internal program. And we all have a version of Pearl who is just feeding back information as we have taken it in. And of course, value tags information by importance, depending on the way that we perceive the world. So if we see it as a really hard place, then Pearl is going to automatically go through like a database and throw back all of the past events and conversations and everything to show that we're right. Now, we can actually change Pearl and use her to our advantage. So I see Pearl as like that negative Nelly, the old neighbor who gossips too much and whatever, and she sits there and she's really, I guess, if you got to know Pearl, you'd understand that she's rooted in fear. So you have to be kind to her for her to be kind to you and just say, look, what you're telling me now is not true. It's not real. It didn't happen. All of these things that we've got going on in our head, are they true? Are they real? Did they happen? And then, and this is why I find meditation so effective, you can rewire her to be kinder. Now, you're never going to completely rewire all the negativity out of Pearl, but you can certainly wire a lot of positivity in. And until I was introduced to my internal program, I didn't know it existed at all. And when I did, it was like mind blown. And once that genie is out of the bottle, there's no shoving it back in. So you either live with the drama and the lies and all the stuff that Pearl makes up, or you can sit with her and have a relationship with her, be kind and change things. And ultimately, you're having a relationship with yourself.
But I love the way that you actually had it as dialogue in the novel and actually see. And I laughed because, you know what, as you say, we all do it. I did it to myself this morning because I didn't finish writing these notes for this interview yesterday afternoon because I was tired, having edited my novel all day. But you know what I told myself? I was lazy. Right. And it's just,
yes,
that's exactly the stuff you do to yourself, that you go, I wasn't lazy, I was buggered.
Yes, and it's okay.
Yeah.
No,
yeah. And I got it done. And I did it this morning when I was fresh and I could actually have a coherent conversation with myself. So yes, I keep going around since I finished reading the novel going, that's just Pearl.
It's good. And I'm getting a lot of feedback about that because I think it's really, you know, I can remember taking off on a plane a couple of years ago and Pearl was like, I get a little bit nervous about flying and I shouldn't. My bloke is a pilot. But anyway, and I was sitting there on this plane taking off and Pearl's, oh, it's awful. It's going to be. And she's screaming. And I just went, sit down, Pearl. And it was like this other character walked into my head who was like empowered. And she sat Pearl in a chair and she went, listen, you know, enough out of you. This is exciting. This is an adventure. And suddenly I had these kind of two sides of the internal program. They both come up. Sometimes I feel the dialogue in the program inside my head is really great and I listen to it and it's positive and oh my God, it's just wonderful to have that at all. Particularly when I'm tired, Pearl will still have a good old nag to me.
She sure does. We touched on this earlier too, but I want to talk about aging and women's relationship with aging. And the message in your novel, and obviously from what you've said earlier to a different question, is that aging is a privilege and something to be embraced. And I loved that you had so many older characters in the novel, such as Tilda's mother, Frances, her neighbour, Maeve, and her therapist, Selma, who are all kind of champion older women, not invisible. And it seemed to me that these older women were much more seen than Tilda felt that she was. And it also feels like that's a conversation that we need to have. I don't know about you. We both read a lot, but it's really can be difficult to find positive older female characters in novels who aren't somehow, I don't know, that are vibrant and three-dimensional and not so serving some story function. Is that what you set out to do, is to create women of all generations and all levels of fabulousness despite age?
I didn't set out to do it. I just know so many great older women. I was in my 20s and I would hang out with women in their 70s and 80s. I have a background in theatre. That's where I started. And there used to be some fabulous older playwrights. And I was at the bedside of my drama teacher when she died in her 80s, with seven women around her bed, like sending off the high priestess into the mists of Avalon, it felt like. But she was probably the most vibrant woman I've ever met, apart from my mother. And Selma is very much based on her, very much based on Zika was her name. So I've just always had friendships with older women. I like older women. And so I just wrote about them. But I think there's a lot of authors who are writing in this space now have certainly blazed the trail. And I've noticed at Better Reading, there are half a dozen at least great debuts coming out this year with the protagonists are at least in their 50s, but often in their 60s and beyond. It makes sense. The majority of people who buy books are women over 45. We want our stories told.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And it was exactly that sentiment that led to my last novel. It's like you're talking about menopause earlier and how there was no conversation around it. And that was exactly that. I just set out to write a woman who was empty nesting menopause, all the things that were going on for
the tricky art of forgiveness.
In this period of life that we weren't talking about it.
And exactly.
Like you say, it's great that the media and people are picking up on the perimenopause thing, but I tell you what, I learned a lot of stuff the hard way during that period. There's also the story of Erica, who was in a dangerous marriage. And the inference I took from this anyway, correct me if I'm wrong, the inference being that she's becoming invisible in order to hide away, and also because she's reduced by this experience, this corrosive relationship. Is that a correct reading of it? Or are you saying that domestic violence is a particular way of becoming invisible?
I think, yes, the latter. It is a particular way of becoming invisible. But I think so many different reasons why women become invisible. But I do think that women who are in violent situations are invisible in so many ways. And sometimes even because they're trying to protect the perpetrator in some way. Look, I have personal experience. I feel quite comfortable writing in the space and talking about both Tilda's childhood experience with domestic violence and also Erica's. And that situation where they rescue her in the book, that actually happened. It was a friend of mine, her daughter was in exactly that situation. It was two cars of us who went in beanies and masks and taped over our number plates because the police couldn't get her out. We needed to get her out of the situation, and then she went and reported to the police. And the doctor had set up us coming and getting her out of there, and we rescued her dog. In my novel, it's the cat. And the outcome for her has been wonderful. She's great now. But so anyone who goes, oh, this actually happened, it did happen. And it was utterly terrifying for me because this particular guy who has been to court now and everything, but he used to come home randomly to check on her as well. So we knew we had to get in and out of there very quickly, and she left with very little. However, she was a lot younger. She was in her early 20s. So I think she was very lucky that she had a very strong mother who refused to allow her to stay in that situation, and good friends, and we went in and we got her out of there. There are people who don't have that support network, and I think Erica was one of them, because in these situations, they're so often cut off from community, from friends and family as well, and you just start to disappear. And I think that's Erica's story in there. And I'd like to think that Erica has a happy ending as well. That's how I finished it, hopeful for her, knowing that she had a long journey ahead of her to heal, but that she would.
I thought she was an incredibly good character. All of this is tackled with great compassion and humor. And I think from your answers that in this conversation today, it's obvious that you have deep compassion. Humor is a particularly useful tool, but it's also a very, I guess, precarious or fragile tool for writers to use because we don't all find the same things funny. But did you start out writing it as a funny story? Did you have to lighten it as you went through the editorial process? What did humor allow you to do with some of these really quite deep and meaningful and difficult topics?
It's just how I write.
Yep.
And probably how I speak in my real life as well. But so I started as a playwright, and that's my background in writing from very early on. And so I love dialogue. I love snappy, funny dialogue to drive a story forward. And that, I think, is how I drive my stories forward in novels now as well. It just comes out. I've sat down in the past, not for many years, but in the past, you look at some really great literary writers, and I've sat down, I've tried to find a voice that didn't have that just humor and lightness to it. And I don't have one. It's just not there. But I understand the purpose of this now. I think it's just who I am as a writer, to be able to explore some fairly serious themes, but do it in an entertaining way. And I love entertaining people. If I can make people laugh, then great. We need more of it in the world, I think.
I think humor also allows you to find joy in the story, because often, even in weird or difficult or traumatic circumstances, there can be humor in life. And I think putting joy on the page is a great way of adding a different perspective to a situation. But I also think surely for you as a writer, it gives you joy in the writing, and then that ends up in the page as well. Yeah?
I love it. I love writing sort of funny lines or finding the best way to say something that people could find amusing. And also I love black humor as well, because my experience, I think humans love to laugh. And in extremely traumatic situations, I have seen people make jokes and say things that crack people up, because that's how we survive. That's the gift that humans have, to be able to make each other laugh in situations that otherwise, how do you get through? And I like drawing upon that and weaving it in somehow, somewhere. And usually, yeah, I think for me, the one thing I need to watch out for is that my characters don't have the same sense of humor.
Interesting.
There's got to be, there's got to be different. One sort of makes puns, one's not really funny, but then we'll have a dry wit. So that's what I tend to look for.
You describe the writing process of Tilda is Visible as hard, healing, and freeing. I want to know, first of all, in what ways was it hard?
I said I really went into finishing this novel at a time when I was deeply grieving someone. So that was really hard. But at the same time, I was very much healing a past relationship. And It's interesting in the edits, as I've gone through those and the editing process, I've had to revisit stuff that, it's a little bit uncomfortable for me. And yet I feel like I purged it all. So I can read it. I'm actually editing Tilda at the moment for the American version. And only over the weekend, I was at one particular point that Tom does something to her and I was reading it again and I just wanted to clock him. But at the same time, Tilda got it all out. Thank you. Cheaper than therapy.
Absolutely. And what were the things that were healing and freeing about it? I guess you just touched on it, but was there more that you found healing and freeing about it?
Just getting it out.
Yeah.
Just and really being clear about what it was. And also the character of Tom with each rewrite, I had more compassion for him as well. Just we're all humans just having a human experience. And he'd left Tilda with quite a lot of baggage. If we're honest, Tilda had come into that relationship with that baggage. She'd been looking for someone who was almost going to give her a certain experience. And Tom enabled that. And I felt for Tom more by the end of it and was able to write a little bit in there that just set him free a bit. He wasn't going to rent space in her head anymore. Yeah.
But I also like the fact that he didn't really change. Like when you have the meeting towards the end of the novel, when he's with the new partner, Linda, I think it was, and then Tilda sees that the same dynamic is happening with her. And I cringed. Tom, to me, was, in one sense, he was an incredibly familiar figure, an incredibly familiar style of guy that I think we won't be islands. I think a lot of women are going to recognize Tom in the novel, whether they had a lucky escape or it was a long journey to get out of it. But I just, as soon as I saw him, I went, narcissist. But yeah, I think also going back to the perimenopause, menopause discussion, I think we also have a lot more useful labels, in inverted commas, but we understand more about this power dynamic in our personal relationships a lot more, thanks to, again, a lot more conversations around domestic violence, coercive control, gaslighting, narcissism, etc. And I thought that you really finally balanced Tom, that he wasn't a cardboard cutout, he wasn't completely dislikable, he wasn't just fulfilling a story function, that you actually rounded him out to be, like you say, that Tilda was did not go into that with her eyes open, shall we say, because she didn't even know who she was. And so
that's right. But also, as you say, we have a lot more information that's out there now and understand what red flags might be. And there are behaviors in men that you don't know until you're well into it. And particularly if someone isn't outwardly abusive.
Yes.
And I think in the book, I have stonewalling as an example of that. So this is someone who in their mind, they're cutting off from the hysterical woman and behaving in a way that, but it's a control, it's a form of abuse. So you don't know until you started to experience these things. And then at first a woman thinks they're crazy and then they go down the rabbit hole and they find out that they're not and everything. So for me to get it down on paper and just go, oh, wow, I am free of that. I am free. And there it is. There's my story. I've told my story, which is fantastic. And as I say, it's not completely my ex. And also the father of my children is not Tom. So I actually have a really great relationship with my ex-husband, who's fantastic. But I did take a few of the experiences I had in a relationship after him and put that onto paper. Be nice to a writer.
Yeah, I know. I always warn my friends as well, do not tell me anything that you do not want to end up on the page.
He's lucky I didn't kill him off. Yeah,
that's right. Exactly. Let's talk about research a little bit. I can tell that there was a lot of lived experience on the page with this book. You're a massive advocate of meditation and you also talk about therapy and retreats. Was it a matter of corralling all of this into one place, or did you set out to specifically research particular topics so that you could make sure that what was on the page was accurate and reflective of the true situation? You touched on interviewing people who were sight impaired, but did you do it in other areas of this novel as well?
Look, I've been exploring the field of personal development in various ways since I was in my very early 20s. And in fact, I first experimented with meditation. I was living in Japan. I was 22 and studied over there. I think a lot of what I bring into the novel is years and years of experience. Now, Tilda goes to a Vipassana retreat. I've done that. And I do write in the author's notes because I won't ruin it for anyone who hasn't read it.
I did. I loved the author's note because I was like, interesting.
Yes. Yeah. Because I needed to change it up a little bit for Tilda's particular story. But I did the retreat. It was very beneficial. It was hell, actually. It was hell. My mind was not a happy place at that point. I didn't expect a spa retreat or anything, but I certainly expected something a bit more relaxing. And it was tough going. Very beneficial, though. And I continued with that style for a few years, but I never really enjoyed it. Also, right at the back that I now do Dr. Joe Dispenza's meditations and work. Now, I had completely given up on personal development, completely, for a few years, because for me, I was still unhappy and nothing had worked. And it was just before I turned 50, and I'm now 55, that a friend of mine she dragged me along to something for Dr. Joe, and I really was not interested at all. It has changed my life. Now, I'm not saying that would change everyone's life, but he uses a kind of merging of science, neuroplasticity, and meditation, and it just really worked for me. I love the community. People hold you accountable. We meditate together. It's fun. It's a lot of fun. And I think that I didn't have fun with the Vipassana, but now I have fun with this. There's a lot of joy in my life with this meditation practice, and it just comes out into everything that I do, really. I did research more of around neuroplasticity and stuff and kind of worked that in, and it was just me. Really, yeah. It was my journey. I've done so much research over so long, I just went, okay, time to write about it.
That's right. Get it on the page.
Yeah.
Talking of writing, it seems to me you're an incredibly busy woman. You're the general manager at Better Reading by day, and I presume you write around that. What has the Better Reading community given you that is unique or special?
I think my job has been a gift to me. Single mum and working in a job where I get to talk about books and talk to writers and read, it's amazing. But one of the things that was unexpected and that has come out of it is that the community is amazing. Predominantly, and this is on Facebook because we have quite a large platform, but on Facebook it is predominantly women over 45. We reach nearly 5 million or just over 5 million a month on Facebook alone, and yet we rarely get trolled. Rarely. It is a safe space for people to come and talk about books, but also to disagree without everyone's arguing about something. And so you get to know the readers. You get to know them coming to the events and chatting in the comments and putting comments on the page and everything. And you become very attached to the regulars. So I love the community feel of Better Reading, and particularly on Facebook. And I just love that people can talk about, respectfully disagree on something that they've read. I love the respect.
Interesting. And so when do you write? When do you write? How does that unprocess fold for you? And do you have any particular routines around your writing?
I generally write a couple of nights a week and then on weekends. I wish I had more time to write. I don't at the moment. When at the beginning of the podcast, you read out what I'd done. I have been writing for decades, but I was a single mum for a very long time and I was a freelancer for a very long time. So my writing was quite different back then. And I'd be at every school assembly, but then writing until 4 a.m. to meet a deadline on a children's textbook. So better reading has given me the stability to just go, okay, it's Wednesday night and I've got 3 hours and I'm sitting down and I'm writing work. You've just got to sit down and put those words on the page, because I think that writing that first draft isn't really writing. Once that's down, then you go back and you really start the process of working out what a novel is. At least that's the way that it works for me. That first draft's quite dreadful, actually.
I know. So, and you come back to it after you've supposedly given it a decent amount of breathing space and you look squinting at it going, oh, am I in for a nasty surprise or a pleasant one or a blend?
Absolutely. But see, I love editing.
Yeah, me too.
I love it. I love going back and looking for the story, and I'm happy to delete words and get rid of things and whatever. So I love that process. It's a little bit like decluttering for me. I'm a great declutterer. So I go back and I find the space in the manuscript.
I think also too that when you write op-ed or journalism, feature articles, whatever, when you've been given a strict word count to deliver by a certain date, is that you become a lot less precious about words, I think, because it's about how can I most cleanly articulate this idea rather than, oh, I labored over that sentence for hours or days or weeks or whatever. Who's got the time?
That's right. And you do. You just, the whippersnapper to them. There occasionally will be a line that I will save for later because I'm like, oh, that was a good one. I really hate getting rid of that. But but it's got to go for the purpose of the story.
Yep, it totally. And the other thing that struck me, because I didn't actually know that you'd written as much as you have before I researched this interview. And the thing that also struck me is you've written a lot and you've written across genres and styles. And I wondered, therefore, how that informs your strengths as a writer. Do you have to strive to improve the stuff that you're not good at, or do you focus on just writing to your strengths? What has all that writing experience and publication experience brought to where you are as a writer today?
Interestingly, I am dyslexic, so I do have some struggles around writing, but the universe has a sense of humour and I was created as someone who needed to write despite it all. I find dialogue is the easiest way for me to express myself, and I guess that's why I started as a playwright. Many lifetimes ago, I had a couple of screenplays optioned in LA, which I wrote, and in fact, my very first novel, I had won a playwriting competition in New York and I was picked up by an agency over there and they said, do you have any ideas for a book or anything? And I told them an idea that I had, which was my first romance novel. So they said, write it. We'd love to see it. So I wrote it. They read it. They loved parts of it, but they got back to me and they said, how about you write the screenplay for it? And I did that. And they went, now sit down with the screenplay and use that as your structure to rewrite your novel. Yeah, I still tend to think in the form of a play or film or something and the dialogue that drives something forward. And that used to concern me a little bit about my writing and how I delivered a story. But actually, I think I've found my balance with it. It's not, I could just deliver the whole story in dialogue.
And also, isn't, if I'm correct, screenwriting would also be in about 70 pages.
Yes, yeah.
As opposed to a novel. Yeah,
that's right.
Very pithy.
Yeah.
Tilda is Visible is out on February 27 as we're recording this. And I'm very impressed because it's sold into the US and into Italy. And probably since I read that, it's probably sold into more places as well. I was reflecting on this as I was writing these notes. I think it in a way reminds me of that, or it's in the same space as Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry, in that I think that one of the reasons to me that book has been so successful is it doesn't matter what nationality you are or what culture you are, that experience is a universal experience. And it feels to me that Tilda is Visible is very much in the same place. And so obviously I hope that it brings you as every success that Bonnie's had with lessons. With lessons in chemistry. What's going on at the moment with the book out there? You just mentioned you're doing some copy edits on the US version, but what's all the exciting stuff in the buzz in the lead up to the book coming out?
there's been so much going on, and some of it I can't even talk about at the moment.
Of course.
Some really exciting things. But I guess I'm trying not to think too broadly at the moment. And I'm looking at what I need to do each day and focusing on that, and also really enjoying that moment. And Tilda is out. I'm really excited about Australian readers getting their hands on Tilda. I had a road show. A firm does their annual road show with some authors talking about their books to booksellers and everything. And after the speeches, I had so many booksellers, particularly older female booksellers, coming up to me and talking to me. And that is what I really want to focus on with what's happening with Tilda. If I can reach women and they talk to me about how they feel invisible, or how something in the novel spoke to them and their own personal experience, it's just going from the heart. That means everything to me, just remaining centered in that.
And how do you remain centered in that?
I meditate.
Meditation. But I was going to say, you've got a new work in progress. Have you got one? Is that what you do need? Are you getting the pressure with such a fabulous book to come up with the next fabulous book?
Yes, but I'm only like about 15,000 words into it, and I've had to put it aside just to manage everything that's going on at the moment. But I will return back to that, and it's calling to me, and it's on my mind the whole time. And I'm enjoying the time just to really work through the threads of who the characters are and where they're all going to go in this particular story.
Yeah. But I also think it's really important, and sometimes you get robbed of this when you've got books coming out, but I think it is really important to live in the moment when you've got a book being released, and to enjoy the experiences that you have with readers and interviewers and all that kind of stuff along the way, because it can be a little overwhelming and really crowd your headspace if you're trying to write at the same time. I think it's, if possible, better to not do that.
Yeah, I've just popped it aside for the moment. There'll be some really great, I'm looking forward to dropping into bookshops and meeting people. There's a whole list of bookshops being set up for me.
Sounds amazing. I hope you have an absolute ball with it all. And I do hope my predictions are right, that the book will just take off.
I hope you've got tarot cards there, Meredith, telling you that.
I actually do have tarot cards. I haven't read for a while, but I used to read a lot. But anyway, that's a different conversation. But yeah, I hope I'm right too. Look, Jane, what can I say? Thank you so much for spending time with us today on the Convo Couch. It's such a pleasure to chat to you. You'll meet you almost in real life.
Yay.
And talk about the craft of your novel. Tilda is Visible is such a fresh, vibrant, deep and funny book. It ticks so many boxes. And like I say, it's a very universal story. I am sure it is going to fly off the shelves. Congratulations. And thank you to Rights for Women as well for having us here today and allowing me to be a guest host on this chat. And for our listeners, you can find out more about Jane Tara and her writing on her website, www.janetara.com. She's on socials as @AuthorJaneTara. She also has a Substack like me, so you can find her. You'll have to remind me, Jane, what's the Substack called again?
Oh, I think it's Author Jane Tara, or Jane Tara Author. I can't.
You know what? I've got the book right here in front of me. Well, let's just quickly go to the page @JaneTara on Substack.
Okay, great.
Yeah, there you go. Don't worry. I know, it all gets a bit like that, doesn't it? And of course, by the time this goes live, you probably will find Tilda is Visible available in all your favorite bookstores or your local libraries. Jane Tara, thank you.
Oh, thanks, Merida. Thank you so much for such a great conversation.
Thanks for listening to Rights for Women. I hope you've enjoyed my chat with this week's guest. If you did, I'd love it if you could add a quick rating or review wherever you get your podcasts, so others can more easily find the episodes. Don't forget to check out the backlist on the Rights for Women website. So much great writing advice in the library there. And you can also find the transcript of today's chat on the website too. You can find details on the website on how to support the podcast through Patreon. And you can connect with me through the website at rightsforwomen.com, on Instagram and Twitter at W4WPodcast, the Facebook page Rights for Women, or find me and my writing at pamelacook.com.au. Thanks for listening. Have a great week. And remember, every word you write, you're one word closer to typing the end.